streets are screaming now. They brought Death Town hometown boys, Death Town hometown.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today we're going to turn our gaze to the South. As I indicated last week, the topic today is what's going on in Venezuela. Important topic, not only politically, but economically as well. And I have a guest here who has frequent connections and access to information in Central and Latin America, Alan Benjamin, and he's going to give us an update on what's happening. I want to say a few things first, though, give my two cents in what I think is going on here. Alan, are you with us? Well, okay, maybe he's not on yet. Maybe the engineers will patch him in so he can participate with us here. I know he's trying to call the station. All right, so let's continue then. Let's continue. It looks like he hasn't called in, but I hope I gave him the right call-in number here. 888-874-4888. Okay. So let's continue with some of my comments. So what's going on in Venezuela? Well, you know, it's intensification of the attack on the Maduro regime there and the Bolivarian Revolution that was launched in the late 90s by the then General Chavez, who pretty much continued that revolution and deepened it, and then died from cancer himself. And then his lieutenant, Maduro, took over as the president for the last several years. But the attacks by the U.S. on the Venezuela regime and revolution has been ongoing for quite some time. There were several assassination attempts to Chavez and others, several attempted coups, financed and directed by the United States, that failed. And now, of course, there's a new push by the Trump regime. Well, why now? Why now the new push? Several reasons, I think. One is we have this new neocon faction in foreign policy running the Trump administration now. You know, the generals that were originally brought on by Trump, you know, McMaster and Mattis and some of the others are gone, unable to agree with him or put up with Trump's volatility and high risk taking in U.S. foreign policy. And he's brought on sycophants and neocons pretty much. To run his administration. Maybe that's too strong a word, run, because Trump doesn't let anybody run anything, really. But we've got this guy Pompeo, you know, a hawk, foreign policy hawk for quite some time in the State Department now. And we've got John Bolton, who was an extreme hawk, neocon from the Bush period there, who is his key foreign policy advisor. So we got the Pompeo-Bolton faction here really running the show. And this whole attack, renewed attack on Venezuela has Bolton written all over it. But that doesn't explain it sufficiently, I don't think. Another factor I think at play here is the collapse of world oil prices in the fall. They've recovered a little bit, but not that much, and they'll go down again. That's coincided here with the intensification of the new attack on Venezuela. Well, why is that important? Well, because Venezuela, 95% of Venezuela government's revenues comes from the sale of oil. So if the price of oil collapses, then the revenues of the government collapse, and therefore the government can't continue its various social programs. And if it can't do that and it cuts back on those programs, then it loses support in its political base. So I believe the collapse, 40% collapse of global oil last fall, has something to do with the planning and the launching of this attack on Venezuela. Now, it's as I said, global oil has recovered a little bit, and maybe the attack on Venezuela is part of that recovery. You see, because if the U.S. Moves to cut off Venezuela oil from access to global markets, that results in a shortage or an anticipated shortage in global oil supply, which drives up the price. And we've seen the price go up slightly here since the beginning of 2019. Well, to what extent has been the elimination of Venezuelan oil responsible for that? Well, to some extent, it's not the full story, but it has had some impact. And it's kind of like a repeat of what the Trump administration tried to do here last summer with regard to Iranian oil. The U.S. Imposed sanctions on Iran and tried to cut off its oil sales to the world market, creating a shortage of oil, and that would cause speculators to drive up the price of oil. But what Saudi Arabia did was anticipating it would get those Iranian oil contracts, jumped in and increased its supply of oil. And then the Trump administration backed off of the Iranian sanctions, as far as oil was concerned, gave a lot of exemptions to companies. So it was a Swiss cheese of oil sanctions on Iran. But at the same time, Saudi Arabia had increased its oil supply. So we ended up with an excess of oil supply last summer, partly due to the Trump policy and then backing off of this Iranian sanctions, and the Saudis trying to get greedy and take advantage of it. So that had something to do. In other words, the U.S. has a longstanding policy: when the price of oil falls, it looks for ways to slap sanctions on somebody in order to cause oil shortages and bring the price back up. Well, that may be at play here to some extent with Venezuela as well. So it's not just the neocons back in foreign policy control. It's world oil price problems here that may also be behind attack. In other words, it's an opportune time now to go after Venezuela, because with the prices low for oil, Venezuela is more sensitive towards its cutoff of its oil, in other words. And that's what the U.S. is doing. It is engaging in sanctions against Venezuela. Sanctions not only imposed on Venezuela, but imposed on its trading partners as well, you see. Trading partners being those who buy Venezuela crude or Venezuela refined oil. The Europeans in particular, Spain in particular, the big Spanish oil refining company Repsol has been buying a lot of Venezuelan crude here, and the U.S. is threatening sanctions on Repsol, as well as others who may purchase Venezuelan oil. To some extent, the Russians and the Chinese have stepped in to try to shore up the sale of Venezuela oil. And what the Russians and to some extent others are doing, is saying, okay, you owe us money, Venezuela. What we're going to do is we're going to take your oil in lieu of your debt payments on the loans we've given you. And that's what Russia did. Russia began in the last 6 months, began taking payments in oil in lieu of money on loans. And Russia also arranged buying a partial ownership of the Venezuela oil state oil company, PDVSA or something if it's called, 49.9% ownership. Well, that kind of, you know, raised red flags with the U.S. You know, here's Russia owning almost half of the Venezuela state oil company. That may have given the Boltons an extra argument in Trump's ear that we can't have this, you see. The Russians actually owning, almost owning, effectively owning the state oil company in Venezuela, because that state oil company still sells oil to a lot of refineries in the U.S. on the Gulf Coast. And Venezuela has a company in the U.S. called Citgo, C-I-T-G-O, Citgo Oil, that provides a lot of oil to the Northeast. And a lot of homes in the Northeast are heated by oil, not by coal or any other means. So Citgo and the Gulf Oil, you know, here's this Russian company, Russia having almost control of the state oil company. No. No, we don't like that. We're imposing sanctions on Russia. We don't want Russia to have any leverage on us, you see. So, you know, I think that's another possible indication of why they stepped up this attack on Venezuela. You know, the Bolton faction, neocons in control, the collapse of global oil prices makes Venezuela more sensitive. This whole thing about the Russia oil control of PDVSA, which is the Venezuela state oil company, right? But it's important, and then of course this is a way of driving up the price of oil to some extent that had collapsed. In other words, pull off an Iran kind of a deal here with Venezuela, cut off its oil supply. Right, that's a back strategy, you might say. Right, another reason is I believe now the attack is intensified is because the United States has rolled over several client states in Latin America into its camp once again. Argentina and Brazil, for example, are good examples of that. And we have a rightward drift in Chile and Peru and so forth. You know, the U.S. is cleaning up its backyard, which it always considered Latin America. And it's pulled off coups, legal coups, and regimes there in Brazil and in Argentina by helping the business parties there destabilize those governments and those economies, which is what they've done. Claiming corruption. You see, corruption is the new ideological offensive that the U.S. uses. In the past, it was humanitarianism, you know, but now it's corruption. Indicate corruption. Then they find the U.S. helps finance these parties and these leaders and helps get the banks to refuse to lend to these countries. And their economies get in a funk here. And then, of course, the U.S. dollar rises, which causes the collapse of their currencies and sets off a chain event of economic destabilization. Okay, so I understand our guest is now arrived and is going to join us shortly here. Alan Benjamin, I want to conclude here with some comments about financial imperialism, which I've been sort of plugging and writing about on my blog, What is Financial Imperialism? And have written in the past a piece on my blog jackrasmus.com. Folks who want to take a look at it. It's a couple years old, but it was, I think, a little prescient about what was coming here in Latin America. And in fact, the piece before that on, quote, how neoliberalism has raised its ugly head in Latin America, and then how U.S. destabilizes economies in Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina. Take a look at those articles. They're a couple years old, but I think they kind of forecast what was coming, and of course it has come. Brazil, Argentina are now in the bag, and the remaining one of the remaining thorns in the side of U.S. economic imperialism in Latin America, of course, is Venezuela. So now they're going after them for various reasons. One of the ways they really go after them that folks aren't that aware about is what's what I call dollar imperialism, right? You wreck the currency of the economy that you're attacking. And the U.S. is very good at that because the dollar is the global currency. It's a tremendous source of economic and political power for the U.S. And it uses that that leverage of power very effectively, right? And the strategy of the U.S. For some time now, and now it's intensifying, has been to deny dollars, access to dollars, for the Venezuelan government. As I said earlier, it mostly gets its dollars from selling its oil globally. So if you cut off the sale of that oil globally, you cut off the sale of access to dollars, you see. And if you get other countries not to trade with Venezuela by imposing sanctions on them if they do, well, that's another way Venezuela earns currency, dollars, you know, to buy things itself. So if the bolivar, the currency, collapses in Venezuela, and it is cut off from dollars, earning dollars, well, what happens is inflation, you see. If it can't get dollars, dollars are short in Venezuela, the value of dollars goes up. If the value of dollars of the dollar goes up because it's a global exchange rate currency, the value of the domestic currency must go down. So if the dollar goes up because of a shortage, of denial of dollars, then the bolivar will collapse. And if the bolivar collapses, then the cost of imports go through the roof. You have import inflation and spills over to general inflation. And if you're a country like Venezuela and many others, you don't have dollars to buy medicines and food and so forth, and you get shortages, and that leads to domestic unrest. So the U.S., through manipulating its dollar, is able to impose a collapse of the currency in these countries and therefore set off this chain event of inflation and unemployment and popular discontent. Well, the U.S. has been doing that for some time, but now it is really intensifying that whole approach. Another way the U.S. has been intensifying the squeeze on access to currency is through the Venezuelan oil company, which sells a lot of crude oil to U.S. Refiners in the Gulf Coast, you see. And it's cutting, the U.S. is cutting that off, that sale of to the Gulf Coast refineries in the U.S. And also, another way is to freeze the assets of those countries, in this case, Venezuela. The key asset is the CITGO, C-I-T-G-O, oil company that provides, sells oil to the northeast part of the United States. Well, the U.S. has frozen its assets and the profits and revenues from CITGO. It's now directing towards this new guy, Guido, who declares himself president down there in Venezuela. So, in other words, we have an intensification of cutting off of currency and access to wreck the economy even further. Okay, so that's, you know, my preliminaries on this thing, how I think financial imperialism is intensifying. In fact, U.S. foreign policy is more foreign policy by sanctions than ever before in its history. That's how it's attacking the economy and wrecking the economy. Of course, the consequences of that are political. And that's why I want to introduce my next guest, who has been very much in touch with political events down there and what's happening. Alan Benjamin. Alan, you with us now?
Yes, I am. Sorry.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. All right. So, Alan, give us your take on what's going on in Venezuela right now. Of course, we know that this the U.S. has recognized and getting countries around the world, governments to recognize this junior, whoever the hell he is, Guaido, comes out of the woodwork. But he's probably just the front man for this guy, Lopez, who has been the main, he's under house arrest now down there, the main guy for the opposition, the main conduit to U.S. U.S. government here. But anyway, we got this this guy who comes out of nowhere, Guaido. So tell us, you know, give us your general take. What's going on, and we'll go from there.
Well, it's an extremely dangerous situation. U.S. government has basically imposed the sanctions, frozen the assets, deepened the economic war to destabilize Venezuela, and Pence announced the impending coup one day in advance on the 22nd. He sent a message to the Venezuelan people, estamos con ustedes, we're with you, announcing the new president before the new president, so-called Guaido with an accent on the O, had even declared himself the, quote, interim acting president. So it's all orchestrated in Washington. It's all aimed at denying people their sovereign right to exercise control over their oil resources and their own destiny. There's been constant warfare by the U.S. against Venezuela, beginning with a coup attempt, failed coup attempt in 2002. They reverted to other means, the USAID, U.S. National Endowment for Democracy, funneling millions of dollars yearly into the coffers of the opposition to destabilize, to disrupt production, to destabilize, to create that unrest that you spoke about just now on so many fronts, not just the foreign front, not just the U.S. in terms of dollars and CITGO, but also internally pushing the private sector, which is still very much in place, to decapitalize, to send their money abroad, to offshore banks, to stop production, to disrupt buses, to disrupt transportation. They tried last year, 2017, with these sporadic uprisings. And what's surprising to many people is that despite all of this, elections have been held, elections which were denied. Of course, the U.S. Claimed that these were undemocratic elections, but the opposition ran. It had its candidates, and even Carter Foundation observers noted that there were no greater irregularities than there had been in the U.S. elections, for example. And it's quite surprising also that the military has stood by and large firmly behind the Venezuelan government of Maduro, who was elected. And this regime change, which the U.S. is seeking to promote, is totally illegal. It's totally a violation of any basic rights, and shows the hypocrisy of these people claiming to be democratic. So it's a very dangerous situation. The U.S. is hoping to use proxy forces to intervene. You know, we know, of course, that Bolton had that notebook with 5,000 troops to Colombia. They have the support of Colombia to act as a proxy force. They now have the support of Bolsonaro in Brazil, who's offered peacekeeping forces in Brazilian peacekeeping forces in Venezuela to ensure the distribution of, quote, humanitarian aid. So they've disrupted the economy. They've forced millions of people into either exodus to leave the country, or just to be driven into near starvation, because there's tremendous amount of hunger. And yet the memory of U.S. intervention, the understanding that it's not the United States which is toppling regime after regime, creating war after war. They're not going to be the saviors. People know that in their heart of hearts. And the U.S. is having some difficulties enlisting everybody behind a U.S.-backed military intervention. Mexico and Uruguay have taken a little bit of a distance from U.S. policy, claiming that you may not like Maduro, but the option of a military intervention and prolonged war, which is possibly on the scale of a Vietnam War, and that's already been voiced by the European Union, might not be the best option. Perhaps we should try to see if we can get people to the table. The European Union has given an 8-day requiring a response within 8 days from Maduro if he would organize new elections. Of course, the only elections that the U.S. will recognize are the ones that the opposition wins. Otherwise, they'll be deemed undemocratic. So, you know, it's a very volatile situation, and it's very, very likely that there'll be some form of escalation in the next few weeks.
Well, you know,
one of the signs, I think, of imminent revolution or counter-revolution, because a counter-revolution is a revolution too, which is what we're looking at, is this thing called dual power, right? When you see institutions that are set up declaring that they are the only true institution, and you have two competing similar institutions, then you know you got a revolutionary situation here. And that's what we got right now. You know, what you've got essentially is this this legislation. I'm not sure what they call each of them. Correct me if I'm wrong, Alan, but we have had this previous National Assembly or legislation. And then we had the U.S. trying to take it over and use it as the source to attack the government, the executive, Maduro. And that didn't work. They've tried that several times. They tried to take over the courts. That didn't work. And there was a legislation in the hands of business interests, tried to take over the courts. That didn't. That's always necessary at some point, but it didn't occur. They couldn't defeat Maduro in open elections. So you had this base of opposition in this National Assembly, but correct me if I'm wrong, I think the Constitution was changed and another National Assembly or legislative body was duly elected. And are there two sort of competing legislatures down there, one that supports Maduro and another one that's in the pocket of the United States?
You are accurate. The government did not recognize the National Assembly that had been elected. It was taken over by the opposition and used as a constant source of warfare against the government. And they created a legislative chamber, not an alternative parliament, but essentially a legislative body that would enable the government to enact policies. On the grounds that the National Assembly had forfeited its independence and its commitment to Venezuela by becoming an agent of a foreign power, which in fact it had. So you have this. It's a counter-revolutionary situation. I wouldn't use the term revolutionary because the masses aren't rising up to claim a new progressive agenda of any kind. It's quite the contrary. It's a counter-revolutionary situation, but it has the forms of dual power. Guaido is proclaiming himself the new president and asking for recognition internationally, which he's getting more and more of. The you know, from what's called the Lima Group, the people that gathered in Lima to sign a declaration of support for Guaido. So it's, yeah, you're right. You have conflicting interests, and it's going to have to resolve it, say, one way or another, because it's not a tenable situation as it is.
It's even gone a little bit further. It's not just dueling legislatures, but the U.S. Captured legislative institution. What you've got now is the head of that declaring himself an executive. In other words, declaring himself a government. In other words, creating a dual power situation at the government executive level, just as one exists now at the legislative level. That's what Guaido is all about, I think, saying, well, you know, I'm the new president. And that's, of course, that comes out of Bolton, I believe. You know, John Bolton there in running U.S. foreign policy.
Guaido is just he's just a fabricated politician. He comes out of nowhere. He has no experience.
Yeah, no one heard of this guy. Who is this guy? You look at him, he looks like he's 20-something, looks like a millennial or something, you know? And, you know, who is this guy out of nowhere? How did he, you know, declare himself? Well, you know, this guy Lopez,
no,
who's really running the opposition with ties to Washington, is really, okay, we're going to pick you because there's no way they can tab you with having tried to, you know, or engineer these uprisings in the past. You know, so he's a clean, easy slate. He's a nobody, and he's a puppet, really.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah, so, you know, the dual power thing continues to develop down there. Where the opposition, I think, is really failing, it hasn't been able to turn the military, and it hasn't been able to turn the courts. And, of course, it hasn't been able to turn public opinion yet. So, you know, it's a very fluid situation still.
Key, Jack, is it hasn't been able to turn any significant forces in the military. There were two attempted uprisings by junior captains in the past 4 months, and these uprisings fizzled because they got no support from the base and they got no support from any wing of the hierarchy. It doesn't mean that that can't happen. One of the leading consul representatives in Washington turned on the government, on the Maduro, and claimed support for the new Guaido supposed administration, as did a consul in Miami, but that's still very, very little. And they're having difficulty because it's very difficult to sell a U.S.-backed regime right now in Latin America. Things have changed. Yes, there's been a shift towards right-wing governments, but the last word hasn't been said. There's a tremendous amount of discontent. There's people rising up in the streets demanding rights against Bolsonaro. These regimes are not stable regimes because the backdrop is one of where the governments cannot satisfy any of the basic demands of the people. So it's the only other thing I wanted to add is that, you know, you have the need. And what's urgent in the United States is to develop a movement demanding an end to U.S. intervention in Venezuela. The Democrats, unfortunately, have lined up, not unfortunately, not unexpectedly, not surprisingly, but they've lined up basically behind the Trump administration on this. There's been a few words here and there of should we look at the Venezuela, the Mexico, Uruguay. But basically, everybody's lined up to say this guy's a dictator, he's got to go, he's a criminal. It's horrendous to see the unanimity in Washington. But at the level of unions, the United U.S. Labor Against the War issued a very strong statement saying hands off, U.S. hands off Venezuela, let the Venezuelan people and only them decide the fate of their country. So there's there's I welcome your show to be able to begin this discussion about, you know, the need for a broader discussion within the United States, that however you might feel about Maduro, it's not the United States, it's not foreign intervention that's going to decide this. And if there's this hyperinflation and if there's this drastic economic situation, it's made in the United States, it's made in Washington, and therefore we are definitely the number one problem facing Venezuela, our government, not we. And that government has to get take its hands off of Venezuela now.
Yes, well, before you came on, I was trying to give the audience a little bit of background on how, what are the techniques and means by which the U.S. has continued to try to destabilize Venezuela, and how that destabilization and those methods have recently intensified in the last six to 9 months. And you're absolutely right. The U.S., when it wants to engage a regime change, the first steps are to destabilize the economy. It uses the dollar and other means, sanctions and so forth, to do that, and an ideology as well as funding these opposition parties and giving them advice and intelligence and so forth. You know, this attack on intensified attack on Venezuela is just the latest in a series of moves the U.S. has made in Latin America. It played a central role in overturning the Kirchner regime in Argentina, and of course, the Rousseff regime replaced with Bolsonaro, well, Temer, and then Bolsonaro in Brazil. So this is this latest attack on Venezuela has to be seen in a broader context of the U.S. Trying once again to control and dominate directly Latin America. I think it's also part of the U.S. Attempting to extricate itself from the Middle East and reorient towards Asia and China. You know, recent days, Trump has announced tried to announce or pull out of troops out of Syria and disengage. Of course, there's been some pushback there by the traditional capitalist elites in the U.S. And then, of course, there's talks now for the U.S. to come up to some kind of solution to save face, declare victory, and leave Afghanistan. This is all part, I believe, of the pivot that Obama announced towards China. And the trade war with China is another example of all that. So I think the U.S. has been trying to clean up with some success, clean up, as it would say, from social democratic elected democracies in Latin America, clean them up and, you know, realign them traditionally the way it has in the past as it turns to a new offensive elsewhere globally. But that's just my view on that. It just appears to be the U.S. is reorienting and cleaning up its shop elsewhere as it does so. But what do you think? Do you think there could be, if you would comment on it, a military option here? You think Trump is volatile enough, and Bolton certainly is, that they would actually engage in a military action, you know, maybe from, well, certainly most likely from Colombia?
I think it's totally possible. I do. When Trump says, all options are on the table, I think he means that. And I think he has the ability through this. It's a certain diversion away from what's happening in Washington. The federal government shut down. He could get bipartisan support for this, try to paint it as an Organization of American States intervention, OAS, and build a coalition of the willing in Latin America to back it, and use it in carry it out as a peacekeeping venture with the cover of providing humanitarian aid and bringing and having the troops come in with food and use a high-profile PR campaign to show that these are this is an intervention to help bring food to the people who are needing it, and then have, you know, photographs of people gathering to get bags of rice and bags of corn or whatever. So I think they have put everything into place. What I think they don't realize is that this could backfire. And I think certain wings of the capitalist class realize that. Just to give you an example, there are a lot of opposition unions or left unions in Venezuela that have been opposed to the Maduro government because Maduro has been quite heavy-handed in terms of trade unions and trade union rights. But even the most critical of these unions say we are behind this government 1,000% in defense of this government against attacks by the United States. And we speak, they say, for the majority of Venezuelans who will not allow an intervention. So, you know, I think that they're playing with fire and they're trying to evaluate it, but I don't exclude it at all. I think that they've come this far. They're not going to drop Guaido. They're going to, if they can work out a deal for new elections, you know, they'll go with that route. But I don't think that the Maduro government's going to accept new elections. They were just elections last May. They won the election. And who has the right to come and tell us that we need new elections? So, yeah, I'm very worried that we could see, an expeditionary force with U.S. troops in the background from Colombia or Brazil entering to provide food for the needy, and that be the form of a military intervention.
What do you think might be the response of Russia and even China should that occur? You think they would do anything in terms of supporting further militarily the Venezuelan regime in response if that actually happened? Or would they take a hands-off kind of a role? We see China doing its best to placate the United States to avoid a trade war. And, of course, you know, Russia, U.S., are sort of on the brink here with the U.S. Pulling out of nuclear and missile treaties. Do you think anything might happen there? And what about Cuba here? You know, in the background, of course, Bolton has been as much anti-Cuba and threatening the Cuba as he has the Venezuela. You know, what's the Cuba connection here with all this?
Well, the Wall Street Journal yesterday ran a piece about interviewing Bolton and others to the effect that Cuba is really the main problem in the hemisphere. Cuba has backed off in recent years from a lot of the rhetorical and other forms of support for these regimes. They've abstained on a number of key votes regarding U.S. involvement and Brazilian involvement in Haiti, for example. It's not the force that it used to be in terms of Latin American politics, but it's still an easy, you know, boogeyman to go after and say, you know, we have to overturn the Cuban Revolution, which is still hanging on with by a thread. It's been, sanctions have hurt Cuba tremendously over years. So that's one excuse. What about Russia? I tend to think that there'll be a lot of rhetoric. I don't think that there's going to be any major, you know, missile crisis type confrontation with Russia, especially with China. But, you know, things can get out of hand. If military in Venezuela decide that they don't want these troops coming in with food, that they're just a cover for military intervention and a shooting war begins, all bets are off. I don't think anybody can really answer that right now, what would happen. I think, you know, there'd be a UN intervention, and who knows? I really can't say. I'm just, I think that things have just come to a head at this point, and the Trump administration's decided it's going for broke, and it's created there's a logic to this that escapes perhaps even their control right now.
We've seen in the last couple of years the U.S. Intensify sanctions on individual Venezuelan business people, you know, freezing some of their assets and, you know, declaring they're too close to the regime and so forth. I think we can probably expect an increase of U.S. sanctions targeting Venezuelan companies and maybe even U.S. companies still doing business in Venezuela to try to force the U.S. companies to pull out and to cause a loss of assets and other wealth of individual Venezuelan business people as an attempt to precipitate a business strike, in order to shut down the economy there. That seems to me as a next potential move here if they want to tighten the screws even further by Washington. What do you think are the prospects for that? Could we have a more generalized business strike? You know, we've seen that occur before. The U.S. pays off all the trucking companies in the country to go on strike and shut down the economy, et cetera. Could that be
possibility? That's happening. It hasn't become generalized, but over the past year, the companies have been taking their money out. They've been decapitalizing. They've been sabotaging production. They've been paying truckers not to transport basic merchandise. So, will it be stepped up in the next period? Absolutely. But the business strike is going on. In fact, many of the unions that I spoke about earlier are challenging the government and saying, "Well, why are you not seizing their assets? These people are anti-national, they're sabotaging the economy, and you're still sitting down and negotiating with them and calling for negotiations. We should be taking over all factories and all enterprises that have been acting against the interests of the nation and placing them under workers' control and placing them at the service of relaunching production to meet people's needs." And their accusation against Maduro is that he hasn't taken firm enough stand. He continues to use very precious dollars to continue to pay off the foreign debt, which was a debt that was inherited from the previous ADE, Acción Democrática, regime. And they're saying, you're paying off using dollars when we shouldn't be. You're sitting down and negotiating. So there's a lot of anger from some of the people on the left in Venezuela that the government has been trying to straddle the fence and hoping against hope that they can prevent the pro-capitalist opposition from undermining and sabotaging the economy. And that, of course, is not working. So they're demanding that the government take stronger action. So this is a dynamic also at play in Venezuela.
Yes, and the more that the dollars leave the country to pay off the debt, which is exactly the strategy of the U.S. to suck all the dollars out, which causes the currency, the bolivar, to collapse, which causes inflation to accelerate, which causes the shortage because you can't buy medicines and so forth, you know. So the more the dollars flow out of the country, which is the U.S. strategy, the more intensified the economic crisis actually becomes. So that's just another way of sending the dollars out of the country. Or if the U.S. takes over Citgo, which it has, that prevents dollars from flowing into the country because it's a subsidiary of the state oil company down there. Okay, so what's the status? You touched on it briefly of the support and solidarity movement in the U.S. With Venezuela. Can you tell us what's going on and where people might be able to go if they want to support that or join in and help that solidarity movement?
Well, there have been a series of protests immediately after the January 23rd announcement of the coup by Guaido, Juan Guaido, and the opposition, U.S.-backed. There were immediate emergency response actions all across the country, mostly small, mostly led by pro-Maduro organizations, but not only. Answer Coalition is one place to go to look for the roster of actions in your cities. UNAC, United National Anti-War Committee, UNAC.org is another place where you can go. I was very heartened to see a statement come out from the anti-war wing of the labor movement, U.S. Labor Against the War, that was so strong, U.S. LaborAgainstTheWar.org. And there's also a listing of actions where you can participate. You know, what's needed is to build a broad movement around the very simple concept that the U.S. has to get out, U.S. hands off, that leaves open the discussion among activists about the regime, who's responsible, what should be done, what shouldn't be done, but that understands that the main culprit here is the U.S., and the U.S. has to get its hands off. And if we can build around just that very simple united front demand, we will have accomplished a lot. And hopefully, we, in the next weeks, days and weeks, we can broaden the anti-war movement around Venezuela to include Venezuela and to build that movement. But it's still, at this point, it's scattered in relatively small actions. Though Maduro did say in a statement yesterday how much he appreciated the anti-war actions that have already existed in the United States, that they are the reflection of the true will of the American people and not of its government. And I thought that that was a very important statement from Maduro.
So, you know, listeners, probably the best source to start to finding out what's going on in terms of opposition support, USLaborAgainstTheWar.org. Right? Are they proposing actions or organizing, or did they just make a statement against it?
Yeah, they made a statement, and I think the website has the different dates and places where people are organizing actions.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with you. This thing could really escalate given the volatility of and the extreme politics of the people on the U.S. side involved here. And, should the Mueller indictment come down here fairly shortly in the next couple of months, should the China-U.S. trade deal not occur, should the U.S. economy get worse and shut down again, already slowing down, and the global economy clearly slowing down everywhere, and the approach to the 2020 elections, it's not impossible that this could be the great distraction, once again. By the U.S. and Trump, we tend to get in wars when the bureaucrats, neocons and bureaucrats and the politicians want a great distraction, and this may be, a candidate for that. Should things deteriorate or black swans appear in the economy, which I think we're getting close to, it's not impossible here. They may see and think they can get a quick win, in Latin America and turn to that. I hope that's not the case, but it's got early signs that it could very well be the case here. So folks should keep a close eye on what's going on here and not just, follow the feature articles in the New York Times. And editorials in the Wall Street Journal as to what's actually happening there. Well, I'd like to thank you for coming on here, Alan, and giving us an early preview of what's going on down there. Maybe we could follow it up and get some other spokespeople from Venezuela, sure, or from other organizations, U.S. Labor Against the War, whatever, for a follow-up on this in a month or so, when we see whether you know what direction it's going in. But it's been very useful for to have this early initial, right, and I promise it will be an initial assessment and discussion of what's happening down there. Again, great. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank
and
you,
I
Jack.
Think that well, you, unless you would like to make some final statement about the situation, anything to finalize, yeah, you'd like to say?
No, I think we've covered the main points, and just to urge people to be alert, vigilant, and look out for actions in your cities and get involved, because if, as you say, this great distraction becomes a heated war, we will be at the center of the hope of stopping this war from, you know, as we did in Vietnam. I'm very worried, and so I just urge people to get involved, be alert, and get out in the streets.
Okay, I think that'll conclude our show for today. I don't think there's enough time. I wanted to say something about the Federal Reserve recent decision to flip-flop and say it wasn't going to raise rates here, which occurred this past week as well, interest rates, after just eight weeks ago saying it was going to raise rates four times in this year and three more times in 2020. A big about-face by the Federal Reserve here, which is really a response to the collapse of the stock market by 30% last fall. It's recovered a little bit, but this is a fake bull market recovery in January in what is essentially a long-term bear market collapse. We've seen the stock market rise here and collapse a couple times last year in February, of course, and then a bigger one in November, December, and I predict we got even a bigger one coming yet. So we'll talk more about the Federal Reserve and central banks and the global economy next week. This is Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. We'll talk to you again.